today on the Run to the Top podcast.
Most of the people who listen to this podcast are going, well, that's all great, but I just want to run. I want you to be able to run too. To do that, let's set you up to be able to run. So when you're running, you can enjoy your run. And here's the thing. I want you to still be able to run when you're 55 and 60 and 70 years old, right? I don't want you to run just when you're 25.
Welcome to the Run to the Top podcast from Runners Connect, where it's all about learning from the best and most inspiring minds in the sport. Together, we can train a smarter, healthier, and faster running community. Now here's your host, Sinead Hockey.
Hi everyone, this is Sinead back with you again for Run to the Top's first episode of 2018, brought to you by Runners Connect. I hope you had a great holiday and you're off to an amazing year. Last week, we had a very special episode featuring Run to the Top's greatest hits of 2017. I asked listeners to share their favorite episodes of the year and a little bit about how those episodes impacted their running. And I got some really great responses. During the show, you'll hear those responses followed by clips from each episode. So whether you've been listening to Run to the Top since its beginning, or you just got started a couple weeks ago, it's a great episode if you're looking for some new year inspiration. Speaking of which, on to this year. We're starting it off with a bang and speaking with one of America's leading physical therapists and the author of Anatomy for Runners, Jay DeSherry. Jay established his reputation as an expert in biomechanical analysis as the director of the University of Virginia's Speed Clinic. And now athletes from all over travel to his REP lab in Bend, Oregon, where Jay blends clinical practice and engineering to better understand the cause of overuse injuries. Unlike the traditional model of therapy, Jay's approach is pretty unique because he works to correct imbalances before they become a problem. Today, Jay will share a little about his new book, Running Rewired, explain how we can rediscover our body-brain movement patterns, and dispel the myths that pervade both the shoe and physical therapy industries. I can't wait to jump in, so after a quick break to thank our sponsor, we'll be right back with our interview. On this week's episode, we're actually sponsoring ourselves. If you're looking for a custom training plan, coaching support, and an amazing team of supportive, like-minded runners, head on over to runnersconnect.net/train. There you can start your free 2-week trial and add your name to the nearly 1,000 fellow runners we've helped achieve new personal bests. Again, that's runnersconnect.net/train. We hope you join us. Thanks for joining us, Jay.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. Jay, I really enjoyed my last interview with you for the Injury Summit, and I know you've been on Run to the Top before with Tina Muir, so excited to have you on again.
Excited to be here. Always fun.
Yeah. So Jay, I want to talk to you mostly about your new book, Running Rewired, but before we jump into that, I kind of want to go back in time a little bit first. When did you start running, and what sparked your passion for the sport?
Sure. I started running back in high school, not by want, but by force. I was a swimmer, and basically, my cross country team was super strong, and coach was always looking for more bodies to kind of train and build a bigger entourage. And I basically was sort of like, advised/forced at Catholic school to start running, and didn't love it because I kept getting hurt. As a swimmer, you have great fitness, but don't have a lot of the skills and strengths and stability aspects you need to run. And so I think thus sparked my frustration and journey to find a better way.
So was that kind of being injury prone while you were trying to run? Was that what kind of prompted your interest in pursuing physical therapy as a career?
Yeah, entirely. I mean, I just, to be honest, I got frustrated at the fact, I was a a nationally ranked swimmer, and yet, you know, couldn't run 5K, you know, a few times a week without something hurting. And you go to the doctor's office and they basically say, well, nothing's broken, don't run. And I didn't like that answer. I thought that was ridiculous. I think that, you know, some of my passion and career, or my passion for my career, definitely was out of frustration for finding better answers, for myself personally, you know, trying to, you know, build a better mousetrap and see what this body can do. So,
yeah,
and taking those lessons along the way, and then ultimately trying to help other folks, you know, accomplish our goals.
Yeah, so. That's great. So as you went through your PT schooling and everything, what did you ever figure out what was kind of the smoking gun, why you were so injury prone? Was there one weakness in particular that you had to deal with?
Yeah, I mean, well, I'd say this. I mean, you know, it's interesting. Yeah, and PT education has changed a lot in the past 10 years. It really has. But, you know, when you go to school, you're basically taught by textbooks. And, you know, textbooks have stuff in there from a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And you're taught by instructors, which are, you know, not everybody for sure, but there's this kind of old guard of medical education and all the stuff you have to learn. And so, you know, when you go to become a doctor or a physical therapist or a chiropractor, anybody, I mean, their goal is just to get you to pass board exam. And there's so much stuff to learn to just pass a national board exam that doesn't even get into any of the technical specifics of the, you know, the kind of niche you want to practice. And so I definitely think that my eyes were open to some things, but I think of a big aha moment for me. You know, I came out of school and I started practicing, and then you're like a deer in headlights because you know all this stuff and you're just dangerous because you know what to do. And then, you know, I think that a lot of my frustration got even bigger once I got out of school and started working and found out a lot of the stuff I was told didn't really work. And then, you know, kind of just to jump ahead a few years, we had a new research lab open at University of Virginia. And the department chair was open to my idea. My idea was to try and look at, you know, use all this great tools we had at the motion lab there to actually, you know, look at, you know, objective factors that drive injury and limit performance. And I think that's when things started to uncover and unfold. And I started to learn the magic behind, you know, clinical exams and true objective numbers and see, you know, okay, look, if you're going to say something's better or worse, you know, measure it, right? So show me somebody coming in baseline and show me, you know, some type of intervention and show me some aspect getting better, right? And, you know, I think a lot of times people get frustrated. Is this stuff worth my time? And I think that, you know, when I to ask people myself two questions, right? The stuff I'm going to give somebody, whether it be a patient or a client or an athlete or whatever, is that really going to help set them up for success? Is it truly going to make them better, right? And so that's the statements I try and get in the basis of what I'm doing is, you know, is this stuff really going to make a difference or is it just more stuff to do? So, yeah, I'd say that's when those aha moments started opening up. And I was like, wow, you know, when we see, you know, A, we see B, but not C. And then that's when stuff really became interesting for me.
That's so interesting. I know, Jay, one of your, you're a big proponent of quality over quantity. That's a big underlying message in your newest book, Running Rewired. And so I did want to talk to you about that. I know your book includes about 15 workouts that are specifically designed for runners. And why, when you were creating those exercises and writing this book, why was it important for you to really put an emphasis on that quality over quantity? Is it, why is it not always that more, doing more equates to accomplishing more, if that makes sense?
Sure. I mean, that's a great question. I think that's one of the things that I struggle with trying to educate every single person I work with, whether it be, you know, through education stuff for, you know, this book or do, you know, in one-on-one kind of presentations or work with, you know, individual, you know, cross-country programs around the country. I mean, it's just, you know, if you back up and don't even look at running, just look at like general psychology of training, right? So there's two types of learning. And I think it's important to understand this. There's deliberate practice and there's specific practice. Okay. And, you know, deliberate practice is breaking down your sport and actually looking at what specific things do I need to improve to get better. And that's not just saying more mileage. And that's basically specific practice. And that's what most runners practice, right? They just base every time you run, you're practicing, right? And so, you know, whatever combination of mobility and stability and strength and power, you know, you bring as an athlete to the table, you put your shoes on, you head the door, and you just keep doing that over and over again. And you get really good at that one pattern that you've ingrained over time, right? And so, you know, the problem is, you know, a lot of our discussion, you know, across all media channels for the, you know, the past 10 years or so has gone into this idea behind what's the best running form. And I think a lot of runners got frustrated because they tried to change their form, but they don't know what the heck to do, right? It's like, oh, well, shorten this, move this, try and move more from your hips. And, you know, you try and get that person to move their hip and they can't even do that, right? That's not even a skill set they have. And so, you know, when you look at trying to make yourself a better, you know, athlete, accountant, chess player, whatever, right? You know, if you look at what you need to do, you need to, you know, work on deliberate practice. You have to break that skill set down into essential pieces and nuggets and, you know, improve those specific aspects. And, you know, running more is not going to do that for you. You know, if you don't take quality time and say, look, what can I do to improve myself as a running athlete? And you practice those skills, then you start to see, wow, I'm noticing I'm moving differently. Like, well, you know, when somebody says, oh, you know, run from your hips, like, oh, I get it now, right? Versus somebody telling you something, you're like, this doesn't click for me, right? I mean, the whole idea, you know, I made a point in the book, you know, the time to worry about your form is not, you know, in the finish line of, you know, your half marathon with your competitor breathing down your neck. It's like, you should have practiced it a long time ago, right? And I think that time is now. And I think that, you know, this book is a chance to kind of take those lessons and try and package them in a, you know, executable, deployable, whatever, you know, cool word you want to use, package for people to practice and get better.
Absolutely. That's what I love about the book is how actionable it is and how much you've kind of broken down each exercise step by step. So there's very little room for error. And with those exercises, like you said, you're kind of they're designed to rewire your body, brain, movement patterns. And I know that may be a kind of a foreign concept to a lot of our listeners. So can you explain what those movement patterns are and why we tend to lose them over time?
Yeah. So I think just in a bigger picture, kind of set the stage here, right? So, you know, people say, oh, well, this book just has a bunch of exercises, and it does have some exercises. But the idea is, you know, I'm not trying to get you to train a muscle. I want you to train a movement, right? And so when you think about, you know, the way we move, it's not just, you know, the way you run isn't dictated by the size of your hamstring or the size of your quad. That has no effect on things, right? Sure, muscles create tension, which, you know, pulls our bones, which are our levers, and drives us forward. But the idea here is, you know, you have a neuromuscular system, right, that actually dictates how much, when, you know, the timing of all those contractions. And that's the skill of this stuff, right? That's why, you know, the person who runs the fastest isn't the person who squats the most, right? It's a person who can use their strength in a very efficient way to propel the body. And so if you think about that from a big picture perspective, you start to say, okay, well, all right, well, then what do you need to train, right? And so I think that, you know, there's lots of stuff you can look at. But if you look at the biggest picture things, which I think runners just miss, right, are, you know, one, this concept behind core control, two, a concept behind counter rotation, and three, a concept behind hip drive, right? And I think these are all aspects that teach us to move with precision. When I say move by precision, I mean just that, like to know how you're moving, feel how you're moving, and be able to replicate that, you know, not just in the exercise, but when you're actually running. And I find that a lot of the stuff, I was joking with one of my coworkers last night, this time of year, I wind up seeing tons of athletes across the country who come back home, right, for winter break or come back to, you know, Northwest, and they come see me because I've been having these injuries all year. And I think that I was joking. I was like, I think I'm going to write a new book called Coaches, Why the Athletes You're Giving Your Runners Aren't Working. Because, like, I mean, seriously, these coaches are giving great advice on a lot of stuff, but, you know, they're being tasked with core exercises to get their athletes. And I'm looking at what these people are doing, these collegiate kids, and these stuff, they're way too hard, way too complex. Mm. And you're having people do, and it's not just these collegiate athletes. I think a lot of runners are basically told an exercise in, you know, magazine of your choice. And it's a great exercise, but they're hard things. And you're not looking at, again, the quality in which someone's performing it. And it's just, you're asking them to, you know, perform a certain level and they can't. And so, I find that, a lot of this stuff is, you know, from core control is breaking down core. It's not about, you know, how many crunches you can do. It's not about how long you can hold a plank. There's no correlation between time to hold a plank and running performance or running posture or anything, right? So it's trying to break this idea of core stability down in terms of, you know, the way you know and can feel how to hold your body, you know, mile after mile. And so like, that's a big thing about core control. It's not just, you know, again, how strong you are in flexion or a plank, but it's dynamic stability, right? Mm. I make the point in the book, you're not going to find planks in the book. They don't exist because I don't believe in isometric exercises, you know, exercise where you hold a static position in a sport which you don't hold a static position. Mm. That makes no sense to me, you know? If running's dynamic, then posture is dynamic, right? It's going to change. You're going to be able, you know, change as you run uphill, run downhill. It's necessary, right? So from a postural standpoint, I really try and wire in the idea behind, you know, feeling and finding neutral. And I think that's something that gets missed, right? It's like we just, you know, we say, okay, we'll hold a plank or do a bicycle or whatever. Mm. It's these are exercises which, you know, a lot of people tend to default to mover muscles, not stabilizer muscles. It's not strength, right? And to not just hound on posture the whole time, but if, you know, you look at, you know, what defines postural stability, it's not how strong your core is, right? It's all about timing. And so, you know, if you look at good postural control, athletes make a plan to move their spine under stability and then move some aspect above or below, right? So, for example, if you look at a normal healthy person, before I move my arm, before I move my leg, I've stabilized, you know, my core, my proximal kind of position before I move my arm, my leg. Right. Mm-hmm. And athletes with poor control or back pain, all these problems we see, those core muscles fire. They fire great, but they fire late. So all those mover muscles still have to move. You still have to swing your arms. You still have to move your hips, but then your spine is uncontrolled, right? Because those muscles act, you know, try to function too late. And those bigger mover muscles overpower the stabilizers. And that's why we kind of get this pattern of, you know, out of whack, and that pattern just persists. And I try and break things down and, you know, try and say, okay, look, we're going to train your core in a different way, right? We're going to basically, you know, teach you how to stabilize under movement and feel this position. And then, you know, through feeling that, that's the same position I want you to do this exercise, more advanced exercises in drills that are in the book, in runs uphill and speed work, et cetera. And, you know, you can run as fast and as hard as you want to until the point where your form breaks down. And that's how you really change form, is by, you know, addressing the positive. So always thinking about, what lesson do I want to teach a runner, and can I maintain that over and over and over again? That's deliberate practice.
That makes total sense, and I'm glad you distinguished between dynamic exercises and the static ones, how those benefit running. It makes total sense that you would want to focus on dynamic in a sport where, obviously, you know, preferably you're staying dynamic. So
yeah, exactly.
That makes total sense. I never really thought about it that way. And so, Jay, we've talked about that, how these exercises benefit runners from a performance standpoint a little bit. And I know a large part of the benefit is also to do with injury prevention. So that being said, I know that in the worst years, this is a sensational statistic, but I know it's true, is that up to 79% of runners will experience injury annually. And this is kind of weird when you think about it, because we've evolved to run bipedally and you'd think we would be kind of good at it by now. So why are injury rates so high today, and what are kind of the biggest culprits behind injuries?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head, is that we, you know, you said we've evolved to run, and that's interesting, right? So in the intro of the book, I basically, you know, put a case scenario out there. You know, I think Born to Run got a bunch of people excited about, you know, this whole idea behind, you know, being built to, as athletes to run. But the reality is, you know, these Tarahumara Indians, their lifestyle is heavily physically based, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you start to talk about, you know, these athletes that are just born to run, you know, they're literally, you know, tilling their own soil, they're harvesting crops, they're hunting down animals, they're like, you know, surviving on the desert. Running is their transportation mechanism, right? And then, you know, we basically, you know, watch Netflix and put a pair of shoes on and hope for the best. And, you know, I'm sorry, people, it's just, it's not going to happen for you that way, right? And so, you know, you start to look at, you know, what's the difference? You know, those Tarahumara Indians aren't born to run. They've evolved to run, mm-hmm. right? It's part of their, you know, literally evolution. And so I think one of the big problems we see is injury rates are we just keep throwing a bunch of volume, whether it's, you know, a 5K plan or a 10K plan or the runner's world plan or whatever it is, and you just throw a bunch of volume on top bodies that aren't prepared for it. Plain and simple, it's too much of the same thing in the wrong amount. And that's practicing more that kind of, again, that specific practice, right? It's just a bunch of volume and intensity training, which is great to train your heart and lungs, but it doesn't condition your pulleys and levers, your bones and muscles and tendons and ligaments and meniscus and everything else to support that load properly. And again, that gets back to, we're not addressing skill development, right? Mm-hmm. We're just not getting people to think about, you know, what running is. I mean, runners typically are, hounded by volume. But again, I try and change the discussion from, you know, what are you doing? What are you feeling? You know, how are you changing your run? How are you changing your body? You know, your body will drive your form. I make that case over and over again in the book. And if you can't feel your body to move a certain way, there's no way you're going to be able to change your form for the better. Right. So, it just comes down to, you know, building those running skills, you know, those running skills, again, are posture control. One of the things we didn't talk so much about is, you know, this idea behind counter rotation, right? You know, we always think about running a straight ahead, but there's a lot of counter twist to us as we run. One leg comes in front of you, the opposite arm tends to rotate in the opposite direction, right? To kind of counterbalance this. And the example I always use is a pellet drum. Those of you haven't, you've probably seen one if you don't know the name of it. It's basically a little drum. It's got a handle on the bottom, and it has the two little strings coming down the side with two little beads on it, right? And you kind of poke between your fingers, and you shift it back and forth, and the beads kind of go bing, 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 back and forth, and kind of, a reciprocal fashion. It's a great analogy to kind of think about the idea behind, reciprocal energy exchange or, you know, a change in a twisting nature, right? And so, if you take that pellet drum and you kind of just, you know, walk down the road and kind of keep it in sync, it's nice and smooth and equal right and left. And if you take that pellet drum and you kind of kink the handle a little bit, so it's got a little bend to it, and try and do it again as you walk, the sync of those beads isn't in sync anymore, right? They basically kind of go all over the place. And it's a great analogy to think about how we run, because if you can't keep everything in check, what happens is the body tends to wobble side to side a whole lot more. And so take home message, if you can't stabilize rotation through your foot, through your hip, through your spine, through your upper back, through your shoulders and arm swing, you're going to have a lot more lateral stress to deal with as you run. And I like to make running, you know, less stress per stride, right? I want to make it easier. And you start talking about, you know, those stresses which continue, you know, result in injury. A lot of it comes down to not being able to either move enough or move the right way, or you can't control that rotational torque through the body. And that's one of the huge reasons I see for a number of injuries. Basically, all the injuries that fall in the category of I can't stabilize my body really come down into a lot of that rotational plane stuff. Mm-hmm. So I really try and work on those. And then the other reason, I think the final reason we tend to see a lot of overuse problems in runners is, you know, deal with this idea behind, you know, what muscles are kind of your quote go-to muscles for propulsion. You know, we live in a society which is very mirror dominant, right? We love to work our quads and our chest, and we work things that are kind of in front of us, and we neglect the things behind us. And so when you look at, you know, better running, it's being able to use all the muscles, right? And be able to drive from the hip, from the knee, from the ankle. Called triple extensions, a fancy word for this. But you want to use more of the muscles in the backside of the body. And the reason for that is it helps you kind of keep the swing of your leg sort of in check, right? In relation to your body position. And again, so many runners love their quads. They know their quads. They have very strong quads, right? And so if you're a quad dominant runner, it forces you to overstride, right? And by definition, overstride is going to put more stress in your body per stride, and it's also going to hurt your economy as well. So we've got to do some steps to, again, you can't say, oh, well, you know, shorten your stride, right? That's what everybody talked about for a lot of years, and you're still hearing that from a lot of people. And for most people, that's a great cue, right? But what happens is if you just say, okay, shorten your stride, you know, to run a certain speed requires a certain stride length, right? And if you just tell somebody to shorten their stride, Well, okay, great. They might shorten the front, but then that stride length got shorter. And then guess what? They can't run as fast, right? So, I mean, it's a simple math problem. To run a certain speed, you have to have a certain swing of your leg. And then so you have people who are just, you know, artificially increasing their cadence to 190 and 5 and 200. You can't sustain that. They're saying, oh, well, I tried this stuff, I said, in cadence, and I tried to shorten my stride, but then my times went down and I couldn't run fast. So I gave up and went back to the old stuff. You know, it's not bad advice, but the way you, you know, you interpret it or were told or whatever, right? That wasn't the right advice. So I try and get people to, you know, the novice riders, yes, they have to shorten the front side, but they also have to learn how to drive out the back. And that's a thing which we don't, you know, again, it's not talked about as much. So I really try and get that, you know, get people to tap into their hip control and, again, shift the propulsive drive from front side muscles to back side muscles. And anytime you can spread the work of muscle, the work out of more muscle groups in the right way, that's always more efficient for any sport. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is that it's important that, you know, about those hip muscles, you know, they actually help steer and control the, you know, the wobble, that rotational energy we talked about in the body. And the quads just can't do that. It's not their job. It's like asking your bicep tendon to do that. It just, it can't do that. So there's a bunch of reasons, again, to work on those skill development aspects. And I think those three things, you know, the posture control idea, the kind of rotation, and the hip drive all fall into that kind of idea behind, you know, move with precision, right? Be able to control your body as you run. And that's the message I think I need to get out there.
That's fascinating. I do want to get back. You were touching on cadence for a little bit there. I want to talk to you about that for a bit as well. But first off, you mentioned something that is so interesting, and that's that to reduce the stress of the impact of running on your body, you kind of want to be able to recruit from a lot of different muscle groups. You said kind of spread out the stress a little bit there. So going off that, I know in your book, you actually, this is pretty shocking, you said that your body has to endure 2.5 to 3 times your body weight every single time you step down. So what does that mean when it comes to strengthening? I know a lot of injuries are chain reaction injuries. Do a lot of them start from the floor up? Is that kind of how it works?
It depends. I mean, so, you know, yeah, I mean, so there's, yeah, it's a good point. And so just a few things in there. Number one, yeah, I mean, I always tell runners, while you think that, you know, running is low loads applied for a long period of time, that's complete BS, right? I mean, it's, you know, you're having to control 2.5 to 3 times your body weight. So if you're a 135-pound woman runner, you know, you've got, you know, 300 pounds, you know, basically every single stride you have to support. And that's how much is load is placed on your bones, tendons, ligaments, muscles, everything, right? And the reality is you have to be able to support that load. And whether you like it or not, that's reality. And so, you know, being able to think about that much stress in your body, you know, running is a lot of load applied for a long period of time, right? So runners do have to be strong. And I think that, you know, knowing that, it's like, okay, well, wait a second. If I think about running that way, I'm going to take a step back and think about, what am I doing? Okay, well, I'm going to do clamshells. Okay, well, great. Again, clamshells are a good exercise to kind of think about getting your hips to fire. Okay. Mm-hmm. But again, that falls under that, you know, skill movement idea, right? What about, you know, body weight training? Okay, well, great. Body weight's good too. But again, you're training for a sport that has to deal with 2.5 to 3 times body weight every stride. Okay. Mm-hmm. Body weight training isn't enough to solicit the type of gains you need, right? So you start working back, you know, that's what I like to do. I like to work backwards. What are the demands of the sport and how do you prepare for them? It's really simple, right? If you had a test to take tomorrow, you'd think, gee, what's on a test? I'll study that, right? And so runners go, oh, well, I'll just keep running, right? So, I mean, I hate to keep saying that, but that's sort of where we are. And I know most of the people who listen to this podcast are going to go, well, that's all great, but I just want to run. And I'm like, yeah. You know what? I want you to be able to run too. And to do that, let's help you win, right? Like, yeah. I mentioned before, let's set you up to be able to run. So when you're running, you can enjoy your run. You know, and here's the thing. I want you still to be able to run when you're 55 and 60 and 70 years old, right? I don't want you to run just when you're 25. And so these are things that I think we need to be paying attention to make sure your parts can survive, right? And so if you talk about that load applied mile after mile, let's make sure you're ready for that.
After the break, Jay will dispel some myths that surround both biomechanics and the shoes we run in. This is Sinead Hockey, and you're listening to Run to the Top at Runners Connect. Nod with me if you've ever been in the middle of a training segment and had to miss a few days because you either got sick or work got busy or you had to travel. I can pretty much guarantee that all of you listening have experienced this before, and that's where having a coach becomes really valuable. When life throws you a few curveballs, we can adjust your workouts so you're not falling behind and not doing too much to try and catch back up. We also do everything we can to make sure you get the most out of every single workout. And that's just one of the awesome features our training plans have. We also build in strength workouts completely custom to your weaknesses, injuries, and goal race distance. Each workout you're assigned comes with in-depth instructions, and we of course build the training plan completely around you. No templates, no modifications needed on your end, just a training plan written to your strengths and weaknesses and designed to help you achieve your goals. If you want to check it out, head on over to runnersconnect.net/train and start a free 2-week trial. We hope you join us. We are back with Jay DeSherry. And Jay, getting back to cadence, I wanted to talk to you about that as well. Earlier, you said a lot of people will strive to kind of hit that 180 strides per minute zone. And I think this is something that has kind of become ingrained in us as runners. We've kind of been led to believe that that's kind of the optimal cadence for everybody. This is a myth that you dispel in your book, and I kind of wanted to talk to you about that. Why is that 180 number not really optimal for every single runner out there?
Yeah, so for those of you who don't like science and just want to look at realistic stuff in sport, which there's a lot of people like that, and I'm one sometimes myself, let's just back up for a second. World records have been won with cadences between 172 and 212.
Wow.
So if you don't want to talk about this whole thing of cadence, you think it's stupid, that's fine. Okay. But if you look at what's winning, right, it tells you there's a range of effective cadences. Okay. And you know, some listeners say, well, I don't care, I'm not gonna run a world record. But I think it just, you know, there's a range of sort of optimal activity, right? And so you know, cadence is something which I think has been mashed in our throats. I mean, the real thing we're gonna look at is this gets a little researchy, but basically it's the storage and release of elasticity in our tendons, which are rubber bands, right? And so the idea is the right cadence for you is dependent on a bunch of things, okay, that have to do with, you know, the contractile proteins in your muscle and the type of the tendon lengths that you've got and, you know, a bunch of things you can't control, okay? And some things you can control, okay? Body weight makes a difference here. Gender even plays into this. We can't control gender so much, but yeah. So gender's there a little bit. And then the other thing is this thing we can talk about later called rate of force generation, which is how quickly you can train your muscles to apply force down to the ground. Oh. But all those kind of characteristics come into, you know, figuring out the most optimal time on the ground. And, you know, increasing cadence or shortening your time on ground is not always the best answer. There's a great article done, you know, trying to remember the exact date. It was a while ago. It was like before 2000. Basically say, you know, your time on ground should be as long as it can be until the point where you minimize elasticity. Okay. And so, you know, this trend behind shortening ground contact time at all costs is actually not smart and actually forces you to generate more force in a short period of time. And I mentioned in the book an experiment we did with USA Track and Field where we tried to force runners to have a super short ground contact time, and everybody in that study got hurt.
Oh, interesting.
So those aren't good things, right? So I think a little research tangent, but the idea is, you know, there are certain ranges, and if you are somebody who's got a cadence, you know, 156 or something like that, that's pretty low. Yeah, it's probably worth increasing your turnover. And I think you shouldn't go from 156 to trying to nail 180 steps per minute, right? In fact, research shows that that's one, you're going to work really hard to do that and probably get frustrated and stop. Mm-hmm. And it's better to increase percentages. So I'd rather have people work on 5 to 10% at a time, right? So if you're 156, we want to work, you know, up towards 162, 163 for a little while, right? Try and work on that for a little bit when that starts to make sense. Maybe try and bump up a little bit further. But, you know, if your cadence is around, you know, 170 or so, if you're below 170, it's probably worth taking cadence into account. But if you're above 170, I wouldn't even focus on cadence.
That's interesting.
And then, Yeah, and the second thing is your cadence is going to change, right? I mean, those of you who are running uphill, you change your cadence. Downhill, you change your cadence. Trail runners are going to change your cadence. Surface changes, you'll change your cadence. With speed changes your cadence. You're not going to be at 180 for everything from a 9-10 mile to a 4-20 mile, right? It doesn't work from a math standpoint. Again, I think that if you're somebody who's got a significant low turnover, it's definitely worth your time increasing that. But for, a lot of runners, I think, measure where you are. You don't have to count to, 180. Just running along, just look at your watch, okay, and then basically say, I'm going to count for 20 seconds, right? If you're hitting 30-foot strikes in 20 seconds, that's, single leg, right? That's going to be 90, which is 180 per double side. So, all right, just do the math backwards from there. So where am I hitting? Am I hitting, 21? That's pretty low, right? So factor, see where you are on that scale and make a determination what you want to do. But don't stress about it. It's one variable. And it's an important variable, but it's just one variable.
That's so interesting. And going off of that, I know a lot of, there's a lot of misconception when it comes to, you were talking about the time spent on the ground. And I think, would you say that has quite a bit to do with the message that runners should be running on their forefoot? I feel like that would kind of tie into the brevity of time on the ground. People really advocating that forefoot strike. Is that something you would agree with?
Agree the idea that forefoot strike and low contact time are linked. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah. I guess my real question is forefoot strike. Is it truly as important as we tend to hear it is, or is that not quite as important? Okay, great.
So here's the reality. So there's a bunch of work on this. I mean, from a research side, from with myself acquiring data on thousands of runners over my career, I mean, I would tell you this. I really care about where your foot contacts in relation to your body. Mm-hmm. I don't really care where on your foot you land, okay? It is possible to overstride with a forefoot, a midfoot, or a rear foot landing, right? And it's possible to stride close to your body with a forefoot, a midfoot, or a rear foot landing, right? And so I don't really care where on your foot you land. Those of you who have tried to force a forefoot contact for a while, you probably find that you can't maintain it for a long time. And it's pretty simple. The muscles around the backside of the calf fatigue. And so they can't generate much force as you get tired. And so then you shift back towards a midfoot or a rear foot or whatever foot strike, right? So I think that foot strike is, again, kind of cadence. It's part of the puzzle for sure. It's not the keystone, right? In terms of athletic performance. And I think that, if you have a super short ground contact time, I call it like the running on coals, right? So you kind of like, land very quick and lightly on your toes as you run. I mean, try and do that for a 10K or a half marathon. You can't, right? It's not something you can maintain. And it's also not very efficient. So, there are certain runners who run great in their forefoot and can maintain a forefoot contact style for half marathon, 10K, whatever. There are certain people who adopt that for short distances and switch to contact styles, a little bit different foot contact style as they get tired for longer runs. I mean, it's just another variable to use.
That's so interesting. I've always been a bit more of a midfoot striker, and I remember this was back in high school. I had it in my head that I needed to be a forefoot striker. So I think it was one day I was going for an easy run and just, spent the first 15 minutes trying to stay on the tips of my toes, which was so stupid. Thankfully, I gave up on that long ago. But that's so interesting. It's so different for everybody. So
totally.
Jay, earlier you mentioned a term called rate of force. How does that play into all of this?
Yeah. So if you're looking for the holy grail, like if you say like what matters, that's what matters, right? So, and I think that and this isn't just a running thing, this is basically all sports that have you use your legs depend on this single characteristic. And again, this is spans the entire research world. If you look at what defines athletic performance, it's this concept behind how quickly you can apply force down to the ground. Mm. All right. And let's kind of dig through this a little bit because it's important to listeners. So if I said we're going to squat, let's just say 200 pounds, right? Okay. So runner comes up, puts a bar on their back for the squat, 200 pounds. If you're deadlifting, I don't really care. Any movement you put a bunch of load on, you can say, okay, move the bar, right? So nobody's timing you on that, right? If you're a power lifter and you're trying to lift, you know, 700 pounds off the ground, nobody says, okay, you know, you have 1 second to do this or 5 seconds to do it. They say, lift the bar, hold it at the top, lower it back down. That's it, right? Mm-hmm. That's the whole task. So strength, right, is time independent, okay? And so we're just saying, can you lift this mass? Okay. Running doesn't, there's no link between strength and performance. It doesn't really exist. Okay. And again, it's not just distance running or track running. It's all running into sports, everything from soccer to baseball to basketball to football, everything, right? The single highest correlated variable, which lab dorks like me measure, is called rate of force development. So that says, based on how strong you are, how quickly can you produce force down on the ground, right? And so if you train, and this is not just a, you know, again, quote, get stronger, this is get more explosive, right? So if I train my central nervous system, okay, to deliver more force down in a shorter period of time, what happens is I put more force down on the ground, which means I rise up more, which means I'm covering more ground per step. Okay. Does that make sense?
It does.
And so now what you're talking about is increasing each step length from a few millimeters, a few centimeters. Okay. And now all of a sudden, wow, you know, that pace, which used to feel like a, you know, say 7:10 pace, now feels like a 7 minute or 6:50 pace, right? And you're not working harder. You're actually putting more force down the ground. You're more efficiently using your muscles. And that's the key thing we try and develop, right? And to do that, it gets, you know, this variable, it's like, you know, it's like anything. Like, what's the most key variable? There's a bunch of stuff under that, right? So kind of we're building up from Maslow's hierarchy of needs to be able to, if you use that analogy, right, to build that rate of force development, you have to have the skills to be able to move, you know, maintain core position under load, maintain a hip dominant muscle recruitment, maintain that counter-rotation idea, right? And then so if you have those skills in your system, and then we talk about training the muscles in our body to develop more force to the ground in a short period of time. That's how you capitalize on an economy, right? And that's the number one thing that runners can do. And I can tell you, if I have runners who come in who've never done strength training before, I measure this little thing called limb stiffness, and I can tell you how specific this is to you. You know, I'll be honest, most younger athletes, right, are, you know, younger, I'm talking about high school and college, you know, their bodies are, you know, they're pretty lean. They're, you know, they're developing every day. They're constantly changing. Those runners, I wouldn't say don't need to practice this by any means, but most of their time needs to be spent on those precision mechanics, right? And cleaning up and building those skills. But, you know, as you get into your 20s, you certainly need to start, you know, looking to, you know, ways to train your body to move more efficiently in terms of economy and performance. And, you know, once you start hitting your 30s and your 40s, you're leaving performance on the table if you're ignoring this message. And so, you know, it's important to make sure that we're constantly, again, thinking about that idea about deliberate practice, right? What can I do to improve that rate of force development variable? It's, you know, take some time and, you know, plans in the book, right? But it's really, you know, learning how to do a better job of this.
That's so interesting. I obviously we won't get too much into this because our listeners are going to have to buy the book to really see all the exercises here. But when it comes to, it kind of sounds like to get better, you have to get better at these other variables to really increase that rate of force. You have to first increase all of these your mobility, your strength, and your core, and so on. So let's say, for instance, maybe a college athlete, they're in their 20s now, and they've had all of this background of strength work. How would they go about increasing that explosiveness and that rate of force?
Sure. No, it's great. So there's a, you know, from a big picture perspective, you know, let's just make sure listeners understand this. This is not CrossFit for runners, right? This is not strength conditioning for fitness. This is strength conditioning for running, right? And that's the key difference. I'm not, you know, the prescriptions in this book have not been written to just, you know, make you generally fit or make you tired or fatigued or, quote, get a workout in. They're targeted to design, again, those specific adaptations of, you know, rate of force development. So there's a bunch of rules in here, right? Like, you know, for number one, for that safety reason, you know, you kind of mentioned earlier, you know, if you've got a lifting, and I kind of state this out in the book, but if you're new to lifting, we have some kind of just simple preparatory stuff you're going to do for a while, right? Until you really get the idea.
idea behind, you know, being able to squat correctly. And I even, before I even talk about that, I basically say, look, get a broomstick and a, right, and just practice, you know, squatting with a broomstick, right, and doing a hip hinge with a broomstick. If you can't do that, do not put weight in your hands. Yeah. You know, that's just like saying, I'll just keep running more mileage. It's like, don't take your problems and put 200 pounds on them. You know, take your problems and clean them up. So I really spend some time making sure we kind of, again, get those precision mechanics built. But once you're there, you know, again, let's go back to the idea behind strength, right? You know, I said before, nobody cares if how long you take to move the bar. Well, for running, I do care how long you take to move the bar, right? So, and in fact, there's research to show those protocols on super slow lifting where you take, you know, 5 seconds to go up or about 10 seconds to go down, all this crazy stuff you read about. You don't need to be crazy and fancy with this stuff to people. You know, it's in fact, I tell people, I don't want you to take more than 2.5 seconds to lift the bar up and lift and lower it down. Okay, and it might be even faster than that, right? So, you know, the weights you're selecting shouldn't be so heavy to the point you're straining. And the weights you're selecting should never be heavy enough to where you're fatiguing and your form's falling apart ever, right? So, again, we're taking those ideas on postural control, hip drive, and then we're saying, look, let's put load on them, okay? And, you know, athletes can learn this idea behind, you know, being able to, you know, apply force down to the ground. And for novice athletes, you don't need to do a whole bunch of crazy power stuff. You know, they'll with the, you know, the right amount of load and keeping body mechanics in check, they'll develop that rate of force development really nicely. The runners who have had some experience, so that, you know, the folks you mentioned in the collegiate or the folks who had some lifting experience you may bring from other sports, you know, or maybe you just practice some time in the gym, you know, it's about getting a plan that's going to, you know, again, kind of unify those skills to make sure stuff is specific to running. So I've got a bunch of things in here on when you should do some of those workouts, because, you know, the most important workouts of your week as a runner are those speed work sessions, right? So we're making sure you're not going into those sessions tired. Yeah. We're making sure that you're always recovering properly, right? That the load is not too high. You know, the compound, I have some compound workouts in here. They're horrendously hard. Okay. But they're very appropriate for people, again, so your collegiate runners or your math, you know, your runners who've got a, you know, kind of a experience of lifting, or, you know, your runners who maybe started out at ground zero, but been kind of working with these plans for, you know, say a year or so, you know, you're ready to move on to those, challenging. It's, it's just the idea behind gradual overload, right? If we're applying a little more stress to the body in a controlled way for, you know, over a period of time, the body adapts really nicely, right? But it's all about making sure you put, again, the right amount of load and the right time. So that's one piece.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. When you're saying,
go ahead.
I was going to say the second piece is, you know, plyometrics, right? So, you know, plyometrics are fun, right? So it's, you know, it's nice to have runners, you know, doing some things where you're kind of working on some sprint skills, working on some kind of just crazy stuff I've got in the book with med balls and, you know, learning how to, again, get some oomph in your stride, right? And so I think that there's a lot of, you know, help and fun runners can have with these workouts, but they're, you know, they're training very specific ways to drive from the hips as you're trying to move quickly. And so those are all part of that pattern behind wiring, you know, wiring the body to move better.
That's so interesting. And I know, Jay, something that I wanted to talk to you about, besides all this, it is related, but oftentimes we runners, we get, you know, we kind of fall victim to big, all the advertising of the shoe industry that tells us different types of shoes can help really fix our form and help, help our performance, when in fact, the, you know, it's more important to really put emphasis on improving our body. So, which is really, obviously, what your entire book is about. So going off that, I know you've done a ton of research in footwear, and I know it just seems like shoe trends have really swung from one extreme to the other. First, it was the minimalist shoe movement, and now it's kind of more the maximalist movement. And, you know, a lot of those shoe companies do advertise their shoes as helping to reduce injury, helping to improve running form, and so on. So what should runners really know about these trends, and can shoes actually improve running form, or is that kind of all a lot of gimmick?
Man, that's a loaded question, isn't it?
I know.
Yeah. So I'll back up and just say shoes are tools, right? You know, you can give me the best tool in the world. If I don't know how to use it, I can't do anything for you, right? So, you know, there's no magic tool. I mean, excuse me, magic shoe. and so the idea here is, you know, you need to spend time working on you. That's the biggest piece of advice I can give. Now, you need a tool, right? You need a shoe. So, what should you be in? I think, you know, the vast amount of runners out there are looking to go and walk into a local running retailer and drop, you know, between 80 and 120 bucks and say, this thing is going to help me. It's a necessary piece of equipment, and I wouldn't look at it as something that's going to help you. I would say it's something that's working with you, okay, if you select the right shoe. And at the worst case, working against you if you select the wrong shoe, right? So most people are in shoes that are too overbuilt, and so it's, I mean, again, people always say, oh, barefoot movement was stupid. Well, you know, look at what's on your local running retailer today and look at what was in the walls, you know, 10 years ago. It's a complete shift, right? Mm-hmm. And whether or not you believe in trends, that has still stayed. Even these maximal shoes that come out, they're very unstructured compared to what's in the wall 10 years ago. So some of these things are trends and some of them are not. They're actually, you know, we've seen things shift and we've gone, okay, let's call our bluff. And why are we doing this? I don't know, because the running retailer wants us to have shoes that are stability, motion control, and cushioned. And, you know, again, people are inherently different and variable, and you don't fall into a slot, right? Mm-hmm. You don't walk into a room and say, hey, I'm this type of person, right? Everybody has an identity. It's different. And you're not going to be just basically one category of shoe. So I think that, you know, there's a need to have different categories of shoes. There's a need to have, and again, because people are different. People run different. People have different surface needs, right? There's a bunch of things. They're different. The shoe for the 240-pound, you know, Masters Clydesdale runner is not the same shoe that a 110-pound collegiate, you know, woman runner should be running in, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a need to have lots of different things in the wall. I think most runners do a disservice themselves because they found some shoe they liked, which is great. And so, you know, they freak out like all runners do. And they basically jumped on, you know, some retail blog site and bought 13 pairs of this one shoe. And they stuck them in their closet for the next 10 years. And you never gave yourself a chance to try anything else. Right. And so, you know, the challenges of retail are hard. I get it. But you walk into, you know, your local store and they say, hey, what are you running in? And they basically kind of get the same shoe, one or kind of pretty similar to it, right? And you never have a chance to try something that's really different. And I think more runners should try some things that are different. I think that you know, there's a lot of good stuff out there. There's a lot of bad stuff out there too, but you know, there's a need to have different shoes. You should be a different shoe for faster runs and slower easy runs sometimes, right? So there's a bunch of things that kind of fall in that question. It's a little bit loaded, but I would say that in general, less is more, and there's a need to have variety of footwear. And I would not say a shoe is going to solve your problems. I'd say it would work with your problems. But if most runners would say, hey, look, I'm going to, you know, dedicate some time again to building a better me. I'm not going to be dependent on a shoe. You know, you're not going to be that kind of person who's like, wow, I get, you know, 200 miles out of this and then my IT band flares up. Well, let's fix the reason why you're having your IT band problems. You probably get 500 miles out of your pair of shoes before your IT band flares up. Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, let's, or not have to flare up at all. So,
yeah, I mean, that makes total sense. I know that was a very loaded question, but that makes total sense. And really, I find it so interesting, all the, you know, all the misinformation that surrounds the shoe industry, and you really broke that down really well for us there. So going off of that, another question, and this will be my last one for you today, Jay, but I know earlier you said that the performance therapy world has kind of changed. Literature has shifted dramatically over the last, after the last few decades. And so how has that really shifted in your experience from when you started your schooling in performance therapy? Is there a lot of, you know, really new information in the works at the moment in terms of biomechanics? Is there something, a lot of kind of misconceptions that have been dispelled over the years?
Yeah, so there's a lot of reasons. I mean, one is, you know, a lot of the quote, you know, old school teachings have been based on old school medical models. And some of those things are still, right, still valid. And some of them are different. And we just realize why, because, you know, this idea behind performance evaluation, right, using stuff like gait labs and things that I have at my disposal, are relatively new, right? I mean, there in the past 30 years, there's, you know, we've had the tools to measure these things. And we're finding out, wow, like, let's ask better questions to figure out the answer to this. And you do your study and you're like, wow, that wasn't what we thought. Right. And so I think that, you know, we're relative. You look at science, right. We're in its infancy. I mean, biomechanical research and performance research is still relatively a small kid. And so, you know, when you have small children, they tend to do crazy things. So, you know, I think that we're learning a lot because we can measure things and test things and evaluate things we haven't been able to in the past. And so, yeah, I think that's one thing. You know, coaches will always say, you know, one of my I value him a ton. Joe Friel is a legendary coach who basically says, research validates what won yesterday. And I tend to agree with that somewhat, but the reality is nobody in a medical model is going to teach something that's unvalidated just because they think it might work, right? That's how trends come and go. So, for something to become interesting, right? And maybe valid in some coaching circles and to really pan out, you start to talk about, okay, well, what's the best way to do something? No medical school, PT school, whatever, athletic training school is going to teach something they can't validate and stand behind. So to get studies to come behind those, kind of sayings or isms or whatever you may, read, it takes a lot of strength, a lot of movement to really substantiate things. And that's not easy. People say, why can't the running shoes just do a study and figure this out? I mean, I do studies for a number of running shoe companies and a bunch of, small firms and a bunch of big picture thinker stuff and a bunch of, I do performance assessments for a bunch of different organizations, and they're not cheap, right? I mean, it takes time and energy to do a study correctly. And, people don't just run around doing research, right? I mean, we have specific questions we try and ask, and we try and do clean studies. I had an email that got to me last week, and somebody said, can you basically find a study that says X, Y, and Z? Because I want to be able to make this claim. I'm like, that's not how this works, Yeah, I mean, that's not how reality works. And so it gets to, what you want to hear may not be always what you're going to hear. But I think to, for us to do a better job, and we're still asking questions, right? We're asking questions every day. And I think that, so I don't know, that's one part of things. And I think the second thing is, I think, we're in a really cool time where, I've been fortunate in my career to have a motion lab, right? And I've got two I work with right now. And so, to be able to come in and say, well, let's not just look at this basic idea I read in a research study, but let's measure you, right? Let's see how all this stuff we know applies to you individually. And that's a really cool time to do that. And that's been the most powerful thing in my career, is to be able to say, let's find out if what you do need to change, right? And so, right now that acquires obviously lots of toys and gadgets to measure these things, but it's a really cool way to do that. I think that's going to be a bigger driver, right? So instead of saying, what's the best blood pressure for everybody, there's some variability there, right? And to know where you are, not just today, but over time, that gives you more information than to say everyone has to be 120 over 80, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a great article I read recently was basically looking at like body temperature, right? And saying that, 98.6 is not everybody's body temperature. there's some, again, there's some variability in that. And we think that everybody has to be 98.6, but that's not reality. There's like, I think it's like 3 or 3.5 degrees of span there, which are different. And you say, oh, it's only 3 degrees, but if you walked into your doctor's office, he says you're 101, you may or may not have a fever, right?
Yeah.
I personally have been fascinated with this because I'm not an 8.6. I'm like 97.1.
Oh, interesting.
Any thermometer. Yeah. So it's like, again, I think that it's interesting to be able to say, okay, where's an average and then where are you, right? Mm. You're not average. Nobody listening to this podcast is an average person. Mm-hmm. And so it's important to take into account, yes, the science, but how does this stuff apply to you? And I think that's where you are, is the tough time of research. You try and control for a bunch of variables, but how do you identify what's unique about each person and make sure the stuff that you're disseminating applies to each person, not just a group of, 20-year-old college kids who happen to show up for a study one day?
Yeah. It is fascinating how much our understanding of the human body really is changing year by year. And so Jay, I know you do loads of research with this stuff and with biomechanics and performance therapy. Are you doing anything at the moment, or do you have any research projects going on currently?
Things going on. So yeah, I'm doing some footwear stuff right now. And I mean, I mentioned before, I think the biggest research project I do every day is doing individual gait analysis of runners, right? It's to be able to figure out, here's a message, here's a trend, whatever, but how does this apply to you? And I think that's the really cool stuff that I love spending my time with, because it's nice to see how individual people respond and making sure that the plans we're giving them respond in the way we want. So yeah.
Absolutely. Well, I thank you so much, Jay, for coming on. We will link everyone to your website and to the Running Rewired on VeloPress so they can purchase that if they like. And just thank you so much for coming and telling us how all this stuff works. It's fascinating. I've learned so much today, and I'm sure our listeners have as well. So thanks again.
Oh, it's been awesome. You asked some great questions, so thanks a lot.
You can get your copy of Running Rewired at VeloPress.com. And check out our show notes today for links to everything mentioned at runnersconnect.net/RC489. As someone who gets runner's knee this time of year pretty much every year, I have already been making great use of the hip strengthening section of Running Rewired, and I have a feeling this year might just be the one I get through the winter in one piece. Knock on wood. Before I sign off, next week we'll be speaking with the founders of the November Project, a free fitness movement that was born in Boston as a way to stay in shape during the cold New England months, and the movement now has groups in cities all over the world. It's going to be a really fun interview, so be sure to check it out. Thank you so much for joining me today, and I hope you're off to an amazing new year.
Thanks for listening to the Run to the Top podcast from runnersconnect.net.